Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. Over the last 6 months, I've had the pleasure of interviewing a variety of government executives who manifest the leadership and commitment needed to meet their varied missions. Each joined us for an hour discussing critical issues facing their agencies. In this edition, we introduce you to four leaders who are changing the way government does business. They are indeed profiles in leadership, and here's a glimpse. Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator of the Office of Research and Development at EPA, discusses overseeing a wide range of research programs from basic studies on the toxicity of chemicals to technology development for purifying water.
Well, the Office of Research and Development, which we often call ORD for short, was actually started 40 years ago, back at the beginning of the EPA. And it was a recognition that everything that we do at the EPA needs to be science-based. And so we started out with a core group of scientists, a few of which are still with us today. It has since grown to close to 2,000 federal employees with labs all across the country. So we're looking at how we get the right scientific foundation for all of the decisions and the actions of the EPA.
For Anastas, challenges can really be opportunities. The key question is, how you define and approach them.
What the question is how do we use that deep knowledge, how do we use that deep understanding of the problems in order to inform and empower the solutions? So it's one thing to say things are, you know, this bad, or, we need to do things X percent better. It's another thing to say, these are some of the approaches that can be taken in order to address not only our air, water, land issues, but how we do them synergistically so that we meet environmental and economic goals simultaneously for societal benefit.
Since taking the reins, Dr. Anastas has set a path forward, providing the scientific and technological basis for advancing EPA's mission. Integration is essential to his strategic vision. It is also fundamental to his effort to incorporate the principle of sustainability into EPA decision-making.
There's a question that we want to ask ourselves, that can we become even more effective by ensuring that these are mutually reinforcing? Are we getting the synergisms that we could be getting if we looked at things from a more systematic and systems approach? And that's really at the heart of sustainability, that very seldom do the environmental challenges that we're looking at divide themselves neatly into an air project or a water project. And so we are stepping back and have reoriented and realigned the entirety of the research portfolio, so that taking this systems approach in order to understand our the questions that we're addressing and the way we define our problems in terms of sustainable systems. Because we went to the National Academy of Sciences last year to ask almost that exact question. How do we make sustainability operational at the EPA? And they've recently come out with a report called EPA and Sustainability, and it's sometimes referred to as the Green Book. And it lays a framework out of what are the analytical tools that either are available today or need to be developed in order to address our questions systematically.
In the end, Dr. Anastas recognizes that none of this happens without a fully engaged, qualified, and professional workforce.
I have been known to repeatedly refer to the mission of the agency of protecting human health and the environment as our sacred mission. And the one good thing is that I'd say everybody at EPA gets that. Everybody at, in the Office of Research and Development gets that. So the motivation comes from that mission. And so it's the clarity of showing how the work that they're doing relates directly to accomplishing that mission. The more that connection is made crystalline and clear, the motivation stems directly from that.
From collecting revenue to dispersing payments, the mission of the U.S. Department of Treasury's Financial Management Service is as varied as it is important. As the federal government's financial manager, FMS touches millions of Americans and virtually every federal agency every day. Dave Liebreck, its commissioner, explains.
We do four things. We make payments for most of the federal agencies. We collect the monies that fund the operations of government. We report on the financial activity of the government, and we do debt collection. This is something that we feel quite passionate about. But when you're making lifeline payments to people every month, you know, Social Security payments and benefit payments to people who really need the funds, you realize that you're doing something very important and very significant. When you're collecting the money to fund government operations and you're doing that effectively, that's awfully important. And when you're reporting on the financial activity of the government, decisions makers have the ability to really understand better the impact of their decisions if they have good data. And then finally, as it relates to debt collection, we feel quite keenly about that in the sense that half of the collections that we do are for delinquent child support. So when you talk to the people within FMS, while it may sound like standard back office kinds of things, when you look at the actual mission of what we do, there's a lot of passion around it and a lot of sense that there's purpose and meaning to what we do.
FMS faces many challenges. Commissioner Liebrich identifies budget, leading in a time of change, and agency collaboration. But he's also pursuing five priorities to meet these challenges head on.
I think that probably we, as most of everyone in government right now, will have the new budget environment as a challenge. We at FMS operate with sort of five overarching priorities, and those overarching priorities are daily operations, doing that well. The second is moving from paper to electronics and everything that we can do. The third is cost management. As it relates to the budget, one of the things I think FMS has done well over the years is really focused on driving costs out. But it's really looking at those core business functions and saying, how do we do a better job of doing what we do more efficiently and effectively? So while I think that number is a pretty significant number, those are, in terms of our budget getting smaller, those are issues that we brought to the table. Those were not really being forced by budget pressures. They were us looking at our business and figuring out how do we really become more efficient in what we do.
FMS has expanded its use of analytics. Here's Commissioner Liebrich.
The debt area is the one that's the most natural, but we also know in the payments area and the collections area that we can use these same analytical tools. Now, let me give an example. In the payments area, if we were taking a harder look at whether there was a repeat payment being made to the same address for the same amount, one might cue that up and say, I wonder if that's an improper payment. And so these analytical tools have the ability to sort of pull it out and highlight it and say, well, maybe we should take a closer look at that, whether that's the right payment. In the collections area, if there's unusual activity in collections, some behavior, the analytical tools can help you sort of look at that and say, well, maybe we should flag that. So I think this has a lot of promise in the improper payments area, for example. I think that ultimately how you want to use your technology and your business intelligence tools is to date, we really use our reporting systems to report on how things are and to look backwards. But what you really want to do ultimately is to have that technology allow you and that business intelligence to allow you to be predictive and looking forward. And so if you're going to get the highest value and highest use out of your technology and your business intelligence, you want to use it for forecasting and predictive purposes along the way. And so I think for where FMS sits, we sit on an enormous amount of data. And the ability for us to use that data to do predictive analysis is a really promising area for the organization going forward.
Commissioner Liebrich understands that the success of many FMS initiatives rests on improving performance, implementing better processes, enhancing operations, and achieving outcomes. Doing this effectively and efficiently involves having the right people with the right skills in the right position.
You know, we take stewardship at FMS and our responsibilities to the taxpayer very seriously, and that permeates everything that we do. When we look at, when we're serving the public, when we look at whether we're giving the public good value, we feel very keenly about that and adding value and doing something that's meaningful.
The U.S. Maritime Administration has a varied and vital mission: advancing the economic competitiveness of the United States while also supporting a viable, safe, and secure U.S. maritime transportation system. David Matsuda, its administrator, promotes the vital role of this industry.
Unlike many of our agency partners, we don't regulate. We're more of a promotional agency. Okay. So while the department's chief mission is safety, we do maintain a strong promotional advocacy role for the maritime industry.
Matsuda explains how he meets this important mission and leads his agency.
We've got about 830 employees, a budget of about $300 to $400 million of appropriated funds, but frankly, we do a lot of services for other federal agencies and manage about $1 billion total. We've got a headquarters office here at the Department of Transportation headquarters, about 250 employees. The Merchant Marine Academy, which we oversee, about 250 employees up there in Kings Point, New York, out on Long Island. And the remainder of the field offices are spread throughout the continental U.S. As administrator, the buck stops with me, and I'm responsible for the functioning of the agency, the overall operation, and as the chief advisor to the Secretary of Transportation on maritime issues and activities, I take that role very seriously. As I mentioned earlier, we have a unique role in that we're primarily an advocacy or promotional agency, so we don't do, you know, the type of safety regulation and oversight that the other agencies do in the department. But I know the Department of Transportation has a strong initiative and is one of their strategic goals to promote the economic competitiveness of the United States. And that is something that is our primary role as well when we deal with the United States maritime industry. We want to promote it. We want to promote jobs, U.S. businesses, economic opportunities for both the workers and businesses in this key industry.
The U.S. Maritime Administration faces many challenges. For its administrator, David Matsuda, it's really about facing the demons of the past.
Probably the top challenge has been trying to deal with the, we'll say, the demons of the past for this agency and refocusing on the challenges of the future, the things we really need to be looking at. I'll say that one of the first things I dealt with when I first came to the agency was an ongoing and contentious lawsuit with a local community in the San Francisco Bay Area. We spent a lot of time and effort settling the lawsuit, and it's been a very successful settlement. The other one that we've dealt with is the United States Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point. We have taken a very strong and intense effort to make sure that the financial control and internal controls are in place to be able to give Congress and others the credibility and confidence that we can handle funds appropriately. And in fact, the school so badly needs them. So it really was a top priority. And again, fixing some of these problems of the past has allowed us to really focus on challenges going forward.
The success of many of these initiatives involves cultivating the next generation of merchant mariners. Matsuda takes seriously his agency's mandate to cultivate this next generation. He points out that his boss, Secretary Ray LaHood, has made it a department priority for the United States Merchant Marine Academy in Kings Point, New York, to be a jewel among the federal service academies.
The key role and mission is to graduate future maritime leaders for the industry. Its focus is working to develop not just mariner skills, not just engineering skills, the academic, but they want to, like the other academies, are focusing on developing the complete person, a strong focus, again, not just on academics, not just on ship handling, but on leadership. And we've seen over time that, you know, these are folks, many of them go on to be leaders in the industry. They work their way up, you know, after sailing for some time and taking that experience and really leveraging it and going on to do great things.
The future of this country's maritime industry may depend on such a commitment. Once again, Administrator Matsuda.
The one good thing about the maritime industry is I found people are so mission-focused and dedicated that we often don't have much of a problem finding good people to work at the maritime administration. The challenge is keeping them and growing the next generation as well.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has an expansive mission, and managing its resources efficiently and effectively as one DHS is key to it successfully meeting that mission. Dr. Nick Nyack, DHS Chief Procurement Officer, offers his insight into the procurement strategies of his department.
Specifically, the mission, as all of us know, is to ensure that the homeland is safe, secure, and resilient against terrorism and other hazards. Specifically, within the Chief Procurement Officer office, as well as the component acquisition personnel around the department, we spend nearly $20 billion a year, and that's 46% of the DHS discretionary budget. Our current focus is on sort of three phases in acquisition: requirements, definition, the procurement process itself, and then finally managing programs. In this sort of rough order of magnitude, $55 billion with a discretionary budget of $42 billion. So of the $42 billion, we buy people and we establish contracts. People, we have about 230,000 employees, 7 operational components under the DHS headquarters structure, and people are all over the United States, and we have a footprint internationally as well.
Dr. Nyack explains the resources that go into meeting DHS's procurement needs and the many challenges he faces.
Under me, there are 1,400 contracting professionals spending nearly $20 billion a year. We have roughly 18,000 long-term contracts and 98,000 contract actions that are performed by these 1,400 contracting personnel. My procurement workforce provides support for 500 programs that directly impact the DHS mission. I kind of look at them as four broad areas of challenge that we have. One is people, two is contracting, three is program support, and the last one is industry government communication, which is a priority that I've established that I want to institutionalize within the department. Specifically in people, we need to have the right people. The business that we do, acquisition, all of the contracting actions, 98,000, gets done by people. We have to have quality people, so that is my first priority. My second priority is contracting. There's a ton of things we have to do in contracting, very specifically fiscal austerity, which means I've got to find ways to enhance competition, reduce high-risk contracts, and basically get a good deal for the government. The third one is program support. So we're not in the business of just awarding contracts. We award contracts to support programs that then meet the mission of the agency. So what are we doing in the contracting community to enhance program support? And there's a number of things that we're doing there. And then the last one is we want to engage industry at the appropriate points in the acquisition process so that ultimately, again, we get a better deal.
NIAC recognizes the need to effectively engage industry.
If half of the discretionary budget is spent on connecting with industry and contracting with industry, that is, it's just essential that we have effective engagement. But I want everybody to know that this is going to be a priority. It will be institutionalized, and they can look forward to incremental progress over the years to come.
Communicating with industry prior to and throughout the procurement process can enable the department to leverage existing technologies, expertise, and experience to accomplish a shared goal. Nick Nyack elaborates.
You have to pay attention to change and plan for that. You need to treat people, your employees, extremely well. You need to take care of your customers. And ultimately, you need to drive business results. In my world, that means I've got to be able to demonstrate we're getting a good deal for the government.
Next up, perspectives on changing the way the U.S. Department of Defense does business when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns.